It is Thursday, January 16th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, what's in a name? Like the Wampus Cats. We learn the stories behind Arkansas High School's mascots.
Plus, winter treats to warm on a final weekend of ice skating in Bentonville. And Mount Comfort Cemetery is set to get a marker commemorating its part in the Civil War.
But first, the Arkansas Department of Human Services says a significant number of young adults is enrolling in the state's private option. It allows people earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level to receive subsidized private health coverage using federal money devoted to Medicaid. Andy Allison, state Medicaid director, says it's no surprise younger people are qualifying for the private option since they tend to earn less.
It's also true, and I don't expect this to last, that the private option is 4/5, 80% of the Arkansas marketplace at this point. We think it'll be closer to half and half over time, but the net result of those two is that the private option is lowering the median age of that marketplace by, you know, as much as a decade or more.
Allison says the influx of private option enrollees, especially younger ones, should help keep premiums low for other marketplace enrollees.
Health costs are spread evenly across all participants. That's where those premiums come from, and private option participants are treated no differently in that calculation than other participants in the marketplace. And so if the age profile of the private option is favorable, which it is, then that'll have a spillover and very positive impact on premiums for non-private option participants.
About 64,000 people who qualify for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act have signed up for the private option, with over half of those under the age of 40. Around 13,000 Arkansans who don't qualify for Medicaid have signed up through the federally run health insurance marketplace.
The General Counsel with the National Labor Relations Board issued a consolidated complaint yesterday against Walmart, charging unfair labor practices, alleging the world's largest retailer has violated the rights of employees across 14 states. The complaint involves more than five dozen workers, 19 of whom were fired allegedly as a result of their participation in protest demonstrations protected by the National Labor Relations Act. The board, headquartered in Washington, D.C., is an independent federal agency created to enforce that law. Spokesperson Gregory King.
According to the consolidated complaint, Walmart unlawfully threatened employees with reprisals if they engaged in strikes and protests.
More than 60 Walmart supervisors and one corporate officer are named in the complaint for having unlawfully spied, threatened, disciplined, and terminated workers for having engaged in legally protected strikes and protests in states including California, Colorado, and Texas. Attempts to settle the matter have failed. A hearing before an administrative law judge is pending. Walmart must respond to the complaint by January 28th. A spokesperson for the company says Walmart looks forward to discussing the merits of the case at that hearing.
You know, Walmart has a strict no retaliation policy, and the terminations that are included in this particular complaint were not made because of any participation or membership of a group. The folks that were included in this were terminated for other reasons, including attendance policy violations and other violations of policy. We believe that it's really important to serve our customers. And when there are associates who do not show up to work on days on end with a no-call, no-show, it's not only disruptive to our customers who are shopping in the stores, but also the other associates working in the store who have to cover their work.
If Walmart fails to prove its case before the National Labor Relations Board, it will have to cease and desist and provide restitution to affected workers, rehire terminated workers, and reimburse any for lost wages.
APAC Central Incorporated broke ground yesterday at Chaffee Crossing in Barling. According to the City Wire, the $1.5 million building will contain 12,200 square feet of office space and will be the first private development to be built on Fort Chaffee Redevelopment Authority property inside Barling city limits. The new office will house 25 jobs while supporting an additional 245 jobs in the Fort Smith area. APAC Central began in Oklahoma in 1911 and moved to Fort Smith in 1926. Under the name Arcola, the company was reportedly the first company to pour concrete at Fort Chaffee in 1941. Arcola sold to Old Castle Materials in 2006 and was renamed APAC Central in 2009.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is adding a new piece to the collection in Bentonville, a Frank Lloyd Wright house. The museum announced yesterday it had purchased the Bachman Wilson House in Somerset County, New Jersey. Diane Carroll, media relations manager for the museum, says the previous owners wanted to sell the house to buyers willing to move the home from its current location.
The house is being encroached on by the Millstone River, and it has had significant flooding occurrences over the past decade or so, and those are increasing in frequency. So the owners determined that for the ultimate preservation of the home, it was going to be essential to move it.
J.B. Hunt is donating the transfer of the house to Northwest Arkansas, where it will be reassembled on the Crystal Bridges campus.
Fairly close to the museum's south lobby, where we will have the benefit of both trees and some woods surrounding the house, but also views to water with Crystal Spring. And those two elements figure prominently in its current New Jersey location. But the other element that we're able to avoid is the rising water that the house currently faces now.
Diane Carroll says the process is expected to take roughly 15 months. We'll have much more on the purchase on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. The search for the next dean of the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas has been narrowed to four potential candidates. Finalists include Cynthia Young, Associate Dean for the College of Sciences and Professor of Mathematics at the University of Central Florida, Pamela E. Jansma, the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Texas Arlington, John W. Richmond, a tenured professor and director of the Glencore School of Music at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and Todd G. Shields, who currently serves as dean of the UA Graduate School and International Education, professor of political science, and interim dean of Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. All four candidates will make public presentations during the next few weeks to make their case for being the next dean of Fulbright College.
U of A Chancellor David Gerhart is at the White House today. He joins about 100 other college and university presidents, as well as leaders from nonprofits, foundations, state governments, and businesses for a day-long summit to discuss ways to make a college education more accessible to low-income and underrepresented students. First Lady Michelle Obama is leading the event, along with members of the National Economic Policy Council and the Federal Department of Education.
Mostly clear tonight, lows from 23 to 26. Sunshine tomorrow, highs from the upper 30s in northwest Arkansas to mid 40s for the Arkansas River Valley. And for Friday night, clear, lows in the mid 20s.
This is Ozarks at Large. SFC Fluidics maintains four laboratories and many offices on the second floor inside the Enterprise Building at the Innovation Center at the Arkansas Research and Technology Park. The firm has recently been awarded a $1.5 million grant from the National Institute of Health, enabling it to enter the advanced stages of a portable and automated medical device for monitoring patients with severe traumatic brain injury. The medical device and diagnostic company was launched in 2003. Dr. Sai Kumar, Vice President of Research and Development for SFC Fluidics, says S is for small, F is for fast, and C is for cool.
We have really cool products and that enable medical device development, because most of the medical devices, as you know, are shrinking and are becoming more patient-friendly, more on-patient type of this thing. So the technologies that enable this miniaturization is what we specifically focus on.
Technologies and products that allow for minimization and integration without sacrificing safety or the quality of the products. One aspect of their work is focused on insulin delivery for type 2 diabetes patients. They have a very unique pumping technology that allows them to miniaturize the pump without sacrificing the performance. The pump is so small and so accurate that it is also being used in animal testing for other medications. Attaching it to the back of a guinea pig or rat, it is dubbed the Rat Pack. It allows more accurate testing because administering the medication can be done as the animal is relaxed and going about its daily activities, as opposed to agitating the animal by catching it and then inserting a needle. SFC Fluidics research is also focused on brain injury diagnostics. The two areas seem to be very different.
Yes, you could say, you know, for example, what they call is they have a merging point in the future, which that merge merger between the diagnostics and drug delivery is what they call as closing the loop.
A simple example Kumar says people can relate to is related to type 1 diabetes. The metabolism changes in response to lifestyle changes, and the pancreas produces different hormones in response to these swings. Developing an artificial pancreas will automatically deliver those hormones that somebody needs based on diagnostic testing. It works the same way with a brain injury. Most of these patients are immobile and have chronic injuries.
So you are talking about an ambulatory medicine, okay, depending upon this thing that we could provide. So the diagnostic, is the medicine working properly? You need to have this thing. So that's the common merging point in the future that we are closing the loop.
Not a medical doctor himself, but rather a PhD, Dr. Kumar says working with not only the medical community is important, but also working with insurance companies, because reimbursability and affordability are both factors. SFC has many reputable doctors they work with periodically, along with practicing clinicians, trauma centers, and with one of their products, they are even working with people in the football community, both collegiate and professional. Ongoing projects for brain injury are funded by the Department of Defense, who has a vested interest in such traumas. Civilians may be familiar with brain injury from car accidents, falls, or sports-related accidents. But in the military, soldiers are often injured during training and, well, real-life combat.
It is a kind of an, I would say, underserved or ignored epidemic kind of this thing. You know, it is growing quite a bit, you know, the brain injury related subsequent complications for the patient and so on.
There is a large spectrum of brain injuries and many ways to treat them. The research at FSC Fluidics focuses on three areas, beginning with triage, figuring out whether or not a person has a brain injury, like a concussion. Dr. Kumar says that right now, a neuropsychometric series of questions is being used. Questions such as, how many fingers am I holding up? Researchers are trying to develop a pinprick blood test that can be administered very quickly, with results in 10 minutes, so that a medic can objectively say whether the brain is reacting negatively to an injury or not. Knowing that something has happened can be as simple as seeing stars.
Basically, you know, that is an indication something has happened to your brain, some impact, and that's what is, by definition, trauma. So how mild is the trauma? Depending upon that, what happens is there are portions of the brain already, what I should say, leaky. And then the protein that is not supposed to be there in the bloodstream gets released because of the injury. And this happens within minutes. Okay, and what we are trying to do, and it is present, okay, at certain concentration for a few hours.
The device that SFC's researchers are developing will be able to detect the level of that protein in the bloodstream with a simple pinprick. He says no one has been able to do this before because of the huge experience SFC has with these proteins, and also because of the high sensitivity of the instrument that is needed. The proteins are found one in a trillion. Kumar says it's similar to looking for a needle in a haystack. SFC is currently developing handheld testing equipment for the purpose of being used on the sidelines of football games to make a reliable decision on whether or not to send a player back into the game. Proper care at the onset of a concussion can drastically reduce its after effects. Though supersensitive testing is occurring inside the small notebook-sized device, it is easy to use, as evidenced by its name, Easy Reader. The Easy Reader simply gives a red light indicating the player should have a CAT scan, a yellow light, meaning wait a few minutes and test again, or a green light, get back into the game. Once a person has been diagnosed with needing some sort of care, the device then becomes a point-of-care type of instrument.
Okay, this person seems to have some kind of an injury. How do we track this person? When can this person be released? Okay, maybe not this quarter. Maybe they can play this game or the next game or something like that. That kind of stuff requires monitoring frequently how the brain is reacting, how the chemistry, body is reacting to the brain. And this kind of biomarker, you know, we are doing it in a more or less frequent monitoring basis. That's what we call the point of care monitoring device.
Dr. Kumar says that conducting a study with a couple of collegiate football teams is the next step in getting the Easy Reader to teams around the nation, both college and professional. The $1.5 million National Institute for Health grant SFC announced receipt of just last week is for the third aspect of their research, for the severely brain-injured patients, patients that are already under care in a Level 1 trauma center, where monitoring can be difficult because the patient is unconscious and no questions can be asked. This grant will allow for the advanced development of this instrument, an MD analyzer, which will sample the fluids coming out of the brain. This allows doctors to know how the organs in the body are dealing with the trauma and if current medications are working. Currently, trauma centers are able to monitor blood flow, oxygen, and intracranial pressure, but brain fluids must be sent to a lab for testing, often taking 2 days, losing precious time in preventing organ failures and even death. The MD analyzer will be placed with other equipment next to the patient's bedside and will provide diagnostic results every 10 minutes.
This is one of the prototypes that we put in display at the National Neurotrauma meeting last August. And this has a disposable cartridge, which allows us to measure the proteins that I was talking about, the brain injury proteins in this one. And all these things, these complicated looking things, are the ones that are needed to move the fluid in a specific programmed way into the capillary tubings, which we were using. And from here, we graduated further to an even simpler device.
Feedback from the medical show allowed SFC's 12 researchers to shrink the device from the size of a large shoebox to that of a small toaster. Ever smaller and ever better, the cartridge has been replaced with an even smaller cardboard-like testing strip that is even easier to dispose of. The FDA is a fan of disposability, and the hope is to get FDA approval after clinical trials in an actual Level 1 trauma center. Dr. Sai Kumar is the Vice President of Research and Development for SFC Fluidics. For more information on the company and its products, visit sfc-fluidics.com.
The latest threat just spotted owls, not humans. It's another type of owl. Shooting this threat is a possible solution and controversy.
At some point, you have to allow these species to figure out a way to coexist or for nature to run its course.
Saving some owls by killing others, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen today from 3 to 6 to KUAF 91.3 FM.
Airedales, hillbillies, and wampus cats? Oh my.
And again, that's just a story. I don't have any kind of factual basis to back this up. But the story is that there were some administrators or teachers or some people involved with Alma High School, and they were having a discussion about what the mascot needed to be. Obviously, the school had been in existence, but apparently they had not really decided upon what a mascot was.
In about 25 minutes here on Ozarks at Large, we learn what's in a name when it comes to high school mascots around Arkansas. That's just ahead.
Last month, Roby Brock with our content partner Talk Business Arkansas spoke with business leaders around the state who said they were confident about 2014 when it comes to revenue, hiring, and capital expenditures. To test that theory in the first weeks of 2014, Roby talked with Lane Kidd with the Arkansas Trucking Association. The trucking industry has been leading others in the state in terms of employment in Arkansas during the recovery from the recession. Kidd began by looking back at the industry in 2013.
2013 was a good time to be in the trucking industry. It was a good time to invest in trucking company stocks. It was even good to work in the trucking industry. 08-09, that whole economic collapse, I think the trucking industry felt it like every other sector.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer companies today or in 2013 than there were then. And those fewer are reaping the benefits of increased freight volume. And Arkansas is home to some of the best trucking companies and private fleets out there.
So when I talked with Judy McReynolds a couple of weeks ago and asked her for some predictions on 2014, here's one of the things that she said. She said that She actually anticipates slow growth in general in 2014. Do you think growth is going to be slow in 2014, or are you a little more upbeat?
Well, I'm a little more upbeat than that, and I think, you know, you have to look at the trucking industry much like you do any other. You have executives for publicly owned companies. You have owners of privately owned companies. The best barometer on where the industry is to ask the owner of a privately owned company, how's business.
Why is that?
And if he doesn't say much, you know it's great.
Is it anybody to know? Huh?
Yeah, and you know the industry is finally, I think transportation costs as a total cost of product is a little bit higher. And to some degree, manufacturers might think, well, I wish my transportation costs were not quite as high as they are. However, as a percentage of overall cost of manufacturing and distribution, transportation is back to where it was about 1980. So even though we're generating more revenue, we're really, as a percentage of the overall cost of a product, back to where we were about 20 years ago.
One of the barometers that you look at in the trucking industry, and it's good for looking at the economy as a whole, is tonnage growth and what is happening in terms of freight movement. And one of the things that we saw in 2013 versus 2012 is that tonnage almost doubled from the previous year. What does that say to you?
Well, it tells you that every sector of the economy is doing better. I mean, you know, all of us who work for an industry like to think that we work for the very best industry there is, that's indispensable. But to a great degree, trucking is one of those industries that sort of transcends every other industry because we serve every other industry. So, you know, people say that trucking is first up and first down. We're a leading indicator of where the rest of the sector industries are simply because we're hauling more freight. Freight tonnage is up. The Department of Transportation keeps a freight index. It reached its highest level in November of last year. So we see for 2014 solid growth, maybe a little higher than some of my more conservative colleagues would like to say, because expectations are always better if they can be exceeded. But I look for solid growth. Arkansas, the employment figures in Arkansas in trucking are, I think, one of every 12 jobs are now in trucking.
And you guys are up 3,900 if you look at over a 12-month period there, too. Yet, at the same time, the industry is going to be dealing with a baby boomer crisis in terms of a lot of older truck drivers, people in the transportation business exiting. What's at work to, I guess, adjust for that?
Few industries require as many people as we do because you have to have people in the trucks. But the truck drivers are still only about two-thirds of the workforce. So about a third of the workforce in trucking are in marketing, IT, logistics. But the average age of a truck driver today is around 56. And that's getting on up. That's almost as old as me.
Second career for you, Lane. Second
that's right.
Career.
I can hit the road. And so the industry, quite frankly, has not done as good a job in one sector. That's the truckload sector. You mentioned Judy McReynolds. ABF is what we call a less than truckload, in that they haul within each trailer many shipments for many customers. Most freight in the United States is not hauled that way. It's hauled one load of computers from the port of Long Beach to Chicago. And that driver is going to have to drive a long way to get to Chicago in a pretty short amount of time. And the lifestyle of a truck driver has simply not been what the industry would like it to be. And so I think you're going to see in the next, say, 10 years, the industry in that long haul segment will start opening more terminals. You'll have what's called relay freight, make the lifestyle a little bit better for the truck driver so he can actually get home every other day.
Two federal mandates have come down that the trucking industry, I believe, has been supportive of. And there's even an Arkansas angle to it in terms of Representative Rick Crawford and U.S. Senator Mark Pryor, and that deals with devices in trucks to monitor drug and alcohol testing as well as truck driving hours. What's been Arkansas's role in that?
Well, we are fortunate in that we have a congressional delegation who still believe that you can do things in a bipartisan fashion, and I have to congratulate and compliment Congressman Rick Crawford in the House and Senator Mark Pryor in the Senate for actually agreeing to pursue and push these two pieces of legislation together, and they were successful in that They're both included in the recent transportation bill. One is a simple device that goes in every commercial truck that will monitor how many hours a driver has been behind the wheel. We've always used paper logbooks since 1938. We allow the driver to fill out those logbooks, and we trust that he's not exceeding those hours. These devices will take all the guesswork out of that. Mm-hmm. We think that's a good thing. Secondly, we don't think that there should be drug abusers in our trucks. I think most of us who share the highways with big trucks would agree with that. So the clearinghouse is simple in that the federal government requires everyone to pass a drug and alcohol exam before they become a truck driver. If they test positive, they won't be a truck driver. They can go do something else. And their result will go into a clearinghouse, and every trucking company, before it hires someone, will simply check to see if this person has ever tested positive. That's a great way to make sure that we don't have people disobeying the law in that fashion and driving an 80,000-pound rig.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. It's far too early to discuss the end of winter, but one of the popular trimmings of the season in this area is almost gone. The ice rink at Lawrence Plaza in downtown Bentonville will close after Monday. Skaters have been taking evening and weekend trips around the outdoor ice since before Thanksgiving. Before that ice is melted, there will be a final weekend, and tomorrow night a special warming bar will be assembled to serve hot chocolate and some special food provided by The Hive, the restaurant at 21C, located just across the street from the ice rink. Matt McClure, the executive chef at The Hive, decided to create a couple of handheld dishes especially for the warming bar. He discussed that menu Tuesday before the dinner rush with me. He found inspiration for a January item, it seems, in a campfire tradition.
We like to do some unexpected events here at 21C, and so it's the ice rink, it's cold outside, not really everybody wants a cold drink. So the idea is to have a warming bar and to have some hot chocolate, just some warm beverages, but also some warm, fun sweets to go with that. So that's why we've got something that's pretty iconic to Southern food is the sweet potato fried pie. But we have another one that we have a twist on, sort of an empanada, which is in a way itself a fried pie, but just using masa mix. And we've put everything that makes up s'mores in it. So it's a s'mores empanada.
So let me see. If I remember my campfire days, you're going to have marshmallows. You're going to have a chocolate bar.
And some graham cracker. All in there, and it's so once you warm it, you know, everything kind of melts and it's gooey and it's pretty delicious.
What does it look like?
It looks like a fried pie. It's kind of a half moon, you know, folded over, and then it's fried and crisped up, and it's you get all the textures you want, and it's delicious.
Where did this spring from? Were you thinking about what's warm and what could be done outside?
I think we have. We have kind of a creative culture in the kitchen at The Hive, and I would say it's just another evolution. We've done some empanadas for parties, and we had the ingredients for s'mores that just happened to be nearby, so why not give that a shot? And that's sort of how it came about.
Yeah, of course, the classic s'more is done over an open flame at a campfire. How will these be prepped?
We actually toast the marshmallow before we make the mix, so it has that toasted effect. We put a touch of spice in there to give it a little bit more, character, and so that it doesn't have that, you know, it won't be a toasted s'more over a fire, but it'll have all those flavors.
Let's talk about sweet potato fried pie. What do you have to do with that?
So we get in whole sweet potatoes. Definitely it's one of the most prevalent vegetables that we have to work with in the winter. and those are roasted whole. We peel them, we puree them, and season them, and then we just put them in pie dough, fold the pie dough over, and fry them, and it's absolutely delicious.
What will these be? Will you be making them in the kitchen here and then taking them over to the rink?
That's correct. Actually, I think we're setting up the bar up on our property over here, so it's close to the rink. We're just right across the street, and so close proximity and easy access.
You mentioned drinks. There will be beverages as well.
We make our own hot chocolate with dark chocolate, milk, sugar. I mean, it's just what you want in hot chocolate.
Is the s'more empanada, is it messy?
No, I would say this is all finger foods. This is all fairly easy to eat. Not that there might not be some stickiness residue, but that's just part of the experience.
You may not want to answer this, but when I talk to you often, you talk about the experiments that have worked, that you're going to share with people. Is there anything lately that you've tried? Like you mentioned this more empanada, that, you know what, that doesn't really work?
We do. I mean, I think part of experimenting and creating is, you're gonna fail sometimes, and that's just part of it. And definitely not afraid to have to scrap a whole idea because it's not working, and just reevaluate and reassess and move forward. But you get things like s'more empanadas out of just kind of a whim of an idea, and it's just kind of a magical little pastry.
What time of day are you able to experiment?
I would say there's no time that we don't. I mean, I would say more production comes in like during the day, you know, around lunch or maybe between lunch and dinner. Once the services are in full swing, where most of our attention is on the services. So dinner service kind of takes everybody's attention.
How long did you have to think about what you wanted to serve before Friday?
I think that is why we are constantly kind of trying to create. It's tough to force creativity. So when somebody comes to you and says, I want a warm bar, go. You kind of hope you have something already ready to go. And I would say we did the s'more empanada maybe 2 months ago, but we kind of had that as a thought of that's something we'd like to do.
So someone may come up to you in the next couple of months and say St. Patrick's or some other concept, and you want to be ready.
Exactly. We have a special menu we're doing for Groundhog's Day.
Wait, for Groundhog's Day?
Yeah. So, and it's kind of a play off the movie where, you know, he keeps waking up, and every day it's like it's the same day over and over again. So it's a great example of the events we do at 21C. So we've got the special menu, and it's a couple of our highlights from the menu when we first opened. It's got our pickled egg salad on it. It's got our sticky toffee pudding. It's got our grilled pork chop with the sweet potatoes and greens, which people still ask about. So it's kind of, you know, it's a great night. They can come in and do that menu pre-fee for the whole courses at a reduced rate, or they can do it a la carte and just get the sticky toffee pudding. You know, we've got the Valentine's Day. You know, we're going to do our own take on the Valentine's Day. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. We've got a lot of events like that that are out of the box.
Matt McClure is the executive chef at The Hive. That's the restaurant inside 21C. The s'more empanada will be at the Warming Bar at Lawrence Plaza tomorrow night in downtown Bentonville. Also at the bar will be hot chocolate and a chocolate and bourbon cocktail. The ice rink at Lawrence Plaza will close after Monday. This is Ozarks at Large.
You can learn about the history of a location in more places than just a history book. For example, while walking around a town, you may notice historical markers explaining why a particular landmark is important or what historical event took place near the marker's spot. Earlier this week, the Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission approved an historical marker for Mount Comfort Cemetery in Fayetteville. Yesterday, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke on the phone with Mark Christ, a member of the Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission, to learn more.
The commission started the marker program as one of its earliest programs. We're working with partners around the state to tell the story of how the Civil War affected different places in Arkansas. Every town, every county had a different type of experience, and this is a chance to get that history out there for people to see. Our goal is to have at least one in each of the state's 75 counties.
What has the progress been like so far? About how many markers do you guys have?
We have
approved, I suppose.
We have approved a total of 73 markers, and we're in 47 different counties.
Earlier this week, a historical marker was approved for Mount Comfort Cemetery in Fayetteville. What can you tell me about the importance of that location?
It is an early Washington County town. There was an early college place there in the 1840s. But the markers will focus more on the Civil War aspects of it. Four of the first Washington County soldiers who were killed in the Civil War, who died at the Battle of Wilson's Creek in August of 1861, were buried in Mount Comfort. Both sides, Union and Confederate, used the town as a hospital at different times during the war. And later in the war, Mount Comfort was the site of one of the Union farm colonies, where they basically had Unionist civilians banded together to protect themselves against bushwhackers, which would allow them to, you know, plant farms and things like that.
Now, once a marker is approved, about how long does it take to actually see that installed? So we have, you know, this week Fayetteville's had been approved for one, but will we see that tomorrow or?
Right. Well, normally it takes 4 to 6 weeks from the time that we send it to the manufacturer until it's delivered. In this case, we're going to try and get a quicker turnaround because the guy who prepared the nomination is going to be going overseas. He's in the military, so we're hoping to get it to him before he ships out.
So is the commission in charge of the design of the markers, and then you ship it off to where to have it made?
Well, they're manufactured by a firm called Siwa Studios, which is located in Ohio. And we use the same design, you know, for all the markers, which is one of Siwa's patented designs. We write the text. There's a, you know, we have basically 13 lines with 41 characters in each line, and it's, you know, kind of a historical haiku to make it work together, but you can really get quite a bit of information into that. And interestingly enough, Siwa, the president, is actually a North Little Rock native. But we learned once we got the program going that Siwa is the same firm that made the centennial markers for the Civil War 50 years ago.
Now, the person that was in charge of the nomination, are they also in charge of installing the marker, or is that something the commission does as well?
Yes, no, the local folks are in charge of installation and maintenance.
And is there a limit to how many markers you guys are willing to do? Because as you mentioned, you know, you've approved 73 markers in 47 counties, so there's still several more counties waiting for a marker.
Right. Well, we're going to keep going as long as we have funding. We're currently working with money from a Arkansas Natural and Cultural Resources Council grant. We've also had funding from the National Park Service's Preserve America program, and from the state of Arkansas. We'll be using some of the commission's money as well, and you know, our goal is to keep going.
And there are applications available at your website. What does the application entail? What all does someone need to do to apply for one of these markers?
Okay. Well, the application is at ArkansasCivilWar150.com, and basically the applicant decides what story they want to tell, and then they provide primary source documentation along with the application to you know, just to show that it actually happened. We have had to reject a couple of applications because the things they wanted to commemorate simply had not occurred. But once we get the application in and we run it through our committee, if it's approved, then we develop text. And if the local once the local folks and the commission agree on the wording for the thing, then the locals send in their share of the cost of the marker, which is roughly half, and the commission pays the other share.
And about how much does the marker cost?
A marker with the same text on both sides will cost $2,130, and a marker with different text on either side runs about $200 more.
Now, does the Sesquicentennial Commission have any other projects in the works right now?
Well, we continue sanctioning events around the state. We have our passport program where, you know, folks can visit 23 different places around Arkansas. And once they get their passport stamped, they can send in the back cover and we'll send them a commemorative coin or a patch, you know, whichever they want. We have our traveling exhibit, which has been all over the state. In fact, is booked into 2015 right now. And this year, the commission is going to work particularly hard in the spring with folks in Southwest Arkansas because this is the 150th anniversary of the Camden Expedition, which was the last large-scale military activity in the state of Arkansas.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time.
That's my pleasure. I appreciate your interest.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke on the phone with Mark Crist, a member of the Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission, yesterday. For more on sesquicentennial plans or for marker applications, visit arkansascivilwar150.com.
Fleming discovered penicillin, the Curies discovered radium, and Einstein discovered that it was all relative. I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, I'm hoping that you'll discover the latest advances in science and technology when we talk to people who make them and find out what it all means to you. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
Listen Friday from 1 to 3 p.m. to 91.3 FM.
It is Thursday, January 16th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellum.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Having babbled about music yesterday, which I declare I know nothing about, I'm back on topics I'm more comfortable with.
Art.
Valentine's, the Art of Romance.
Oh, at the RAM in Fort Smith.
Opening today at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. The exhibit includes some 100 St. Valentine's Day greeting cards, postcards, and the wonderful three-dimensional foldouts that were really popular in the United States and Europe. When I was a little girl, my aunt had a whole bunch of those, and if I was very good, she would let me unfold them and look at them. So this will be a lot of fun, and the exhibit continues through April. So you have plenty of time. Museum hours are 11 to 6 Thursday through Saturday and 1 to 5 on Sunday. And RAM is now
open 6 days a week.
And free. And also in Fort Smith, and also opening tonight, an exhibit called Mona Key, the Kimono as Language.
Sounds interesting.
Created by an artist named Arlene Wilson, who graduated from West Ark in 1988. And has been working as an artist for 20 years. And she says the show is a visual response to the country and people of Japan, consisting of a series of handmade kimonos. The images I received in email are gorgeous.
And for those who have recently moved here, West Ark, the former name, one of the former names of the University of Arkansas Fort Smith.
Exactly. This exhibit will be open through the month of February. It is also free. And you can find it more at 788-7300.
And where is the exhibit?
It is in the Smith Pendergraft Campus Center at UAFS.
All right. Very good.
Lots of art in Fort Smith.
Yep.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. When we've taken some time to find out the inspiration for names in our region, we've concentrated on lakes, parks, streets, even cities. This month, we tried to find out what's in a name when it comes to school mascots. That's the kind of music you hear when you're put on hold. And if you ask people at school administration offices if they know the history of why their teams are the Tigers, Lions, or Bears, you'll hear plenty of this. That's because many schools have had their mascots for decades, and for most, nearly all, there isn't a certified date when the mascot was adopted. Fortunately, there are legends and stories for many schools, and we'll hear a few of them in a moment. First, some raw numbers. In Arkansas, the most popular high school mascot is the Tiger. There are 20 schools that use the Tiger. In fact, feline mascots are all over the place. 18 Panthers, a dozen Lions, 8 Wildcats, 6 Bobcats, 5 Leopards, 2 Cougars, and 1 Jaguar. Also popular, Bulldogs, 18 of them, Eagles, and Hornets. And there are no accepted theories why landlocked Arkansas is so enamored with pirates. 11 schools selected pirates as mascots. While there may be an interesting story why one school picked Yellow Jacket and another the Mustangs, the truly interesting stories are surely behind the unusual picks like Airedales and Little Johns. The former, the Airedale, is the chosen mascot for Alma, and it may have come from looking at the right place at the right time. Mike McSpadden is the assistant superintendent for the Alma School District. He says there is a legend that dates back to, people think, the 1920s.
And again, that's just a story. I don't have any kind of factual basis to back this up, but the story is that there were some administrators or teachers or some people involved with Alma High School, and they were having a discussion about what the mascot needed to be. Obviously, the school had been in existence, but apparently they had not really decided upon what a mascot was. And about that time, they were standing out in front of what was then Alma High School, and about that time, an Airedale dog was walking by or was out in that vicinity, or they saw an Airedale, and somebody said, well, how about the Airedales?
The choice stuck and conveniently gives the school an alliterative mascot, something fun to say. Mike McSpadden also points out that however the mascot was chosen, it also has given the school an ability to break away from the crowd, since there are very few teams anywhere called the Airedales.
I have not ever come across any. I know certainly there are not any others in the state of Arkansas, and I am not aware of any others, you know, anywhere in the United States, and that includes high schools and colleges. There may be some, but I have never heard of another one.
Safe to say that if Alma ever met Danville on the field or court, it would be the only matchup ever between Airedales and Little Johns. Danville, in Yell County, has cheered on the Little Johns for as long as anybody can remember.
I have been a Little John for a long time, and I'm very proud to be a Little John.
Nancy Barrick is the principal at Danville Elementary School. She's been either a teacher or administrator in the district for 33 years, and before that, she attended school in Danville, where she grew up.
A little history. There's been times throughout the years that people have tried to come up with, you know, maybe an animal, like a lion or a pirate or something physical that, or visual that you could see, and we were never happy with that. I believe one year back after World War I, we were a Wolverine or something, and nobody was happy with that, and they changed it back to the Danville Little Johns.
So what is this Little John that has so much loyalty among locals? Local, it turns out, is the key word. Little John is inspired by a local legend, a legend that is one of the most beloved for the state of Arkansas, of a French explorer and the woman who loved him. As the story goes, the explorer was given royal permission to seek land in what the French thought was the New World. His fiancée wanted to accompany him, but he refused because he thought the journey would be too dangerous. The resourceful woman disguised herself as a cabin boy to be close to her love. The ruse was so effective, according to legend, that even the object of her love didn't recognize her as his party crossed the ocean, navigated the Mississippi and Arkansas rivers, and eventually came to a mountain in Arkansas. When the party decided to return to France, the cabin boy became ill with a mysterious and eventually fatal malady. Upon the preparation for burial, the true identity was discovered. She was buried on the mountaintop, a mountain named for the nickname she had been given as a cabin boy, Petit Jean, or French for Little John.
Danville's located on the banks of the Petit Jean River. And, of course, Petit Jean, Petit Jean, is French for Little John. And we are in a beautiful area of west central Arkansas. We're in the Tri-Peaks region with Mount Magazine, Nebo, and then, of course, Petit Jean Mountain.
Unusual and tied to the immediate area. An A-plus mascot, right? Nancy Barrick thinks so, but she says when she was in school, the mascot was the target of jeering by students at other schools.
I played basketball throughout my high school career here, and it was not unusual to see my basketball number with a toilet and me being flushed, you know, down the Little John. But anyway, we are proud of it, and it's not something, like I said, is visual that you can see.
Unlike most schools, there is no emblem or physical manifestation of a Little John, no character to put on banners or ball caps. Nancy Barrick says when school administrators are asked by outsiders just what is a Little John, the proper response is
someone that's brave and courageous, someone that doesn't give up. I'm sure it was very dangerous for her to travel across the oceans and up into Indian territory and all, but she was courageous and brave and didn't give up and had a good heart. And that sums up what a Little John is.
Some mascots are one of a kind, and even if the exact story or date of origin isn't known, they make sense to the ear, the elk and elks or the deer antlers, for example. While most schools can't pinpoint the exact year or reason their mascot has become synonymous with their teams, at least one school in the region can. The Harrison Goblins have a family, or goblin tree, we can use for genealogical purposes.
I have heard the history, but I can't tell you what it is offhand.
That's fine, that's fine.
Okay, just a second. Let me transfer you to Linda.
Call the Harrison School Administration, and in about a minute or two, you'll be emailed the story. It turns out the goblin was born on Halloween 1926. Tom Millard, who had graduated in 1927, coined the name for the first issue of the school newspaper. The top story in that first issue, an account of the undefeated basketball team. Goblins stuck. The goblin, by the way, was grinning until 1968. That's when football coach Hewlin Quattlebaum wanted a meaner goblin. The official story says a junior on the 1968 football squad, Mike Thunder Thornton, ordered decals of a snarling goblin with ragged hair for the team's helmets. And the meaner goblin has remained the mascot ever since. No matter why a school has adopted its mascot, people get used to it, become downright passionate about it. And Mike McSpadden, assistant superintendent at Alma, says people there can be thankful it was an Airedale that walked by the school's administration way back when.
I don't know if that was some sort of an omen or a sign from God or even if it really happened. If that did happen, I'm just thankful that it wasn't a skunk that went by at that particular time.
Well, maybe one did, but it just didn't capture their imagination.
Maybe so. Maybe so. We don't want to be the skunk, so let's be the Airedales.
This is Ozarks at Large.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We've got new music from Matt Schofield, the Blues Doctors, Sean Chambers, and local musicians Jigsaw Mudd. They won the International Blues Challenge in Fort Smith, and they get to compete at the international level in Memphis next week. The Generic Blue Show, every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Chester.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow for an all-new edition. You and I back Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow, not an April Fool's edition, obviously, but we are talking about an ice rink on stage at Walton Arts Center and a Frank Lloyd Wright house being built in Bentonville.
Exciting things.
Yes.
Yes. Well, the Waco Winter Classic is this evening at George's. It's a chance for local bands to try to win
a spot
at Wakarusa.
Absolutely.
Coincidentally, today, the Wakarusa officials announced the final lineup of bands performing at Wakarusa in Ozark on Mulberry Mountain this summer. J. Roddy Walston will be one of those. Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros, who I believe were there a couple of years ago.
I saw them there, yes.
Returning. The Business and the String Cheese Incident. So we will end with this song from the String Cheese Incident.